This is Larry Kirkhart and Elizabeth Kirkhart, December 7, 2007. Jung, Psychological Type, and Individuation. This was the audio track from a DVD that's in the library at the Jung Society.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome. Another evening at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. And I will turn this over in a few minutes to Jay Neubauer to introduce our speakers tonight, Larry and Elizabeth Kirkhart. But I think you should give them a big hand because they're from Portland and they made it here. So we definitely welcome them to Seattle.
Good evening. I didn't know Larry very well, but this week we got to know each other a lot, talking about transportation and how this was all going to happen. So I really do thank them for making the effort to get here, because about every half day it changed as to what might be the options. And they eventually came on the train, in case you're interested. Got here early, and we're all doing fine. So it's really my pleasure. I'm a person who trained years ago in England to administer the MBTI, have been really fascinated with it, love using it with organizations, with groups, and particularly with coaching. I think just helping people, supporting people to find that sense of who the best they are. I think for me, it really helps me with the process of individuation and really helping people see what's the best of who they are, not trying to change themselves to fit the organization or their partner or whoever else. So I was so pleased when Elizabeth and Larry were willing to come and talk with us. And you've read about them. I don't need to spend a lot of time telling you, but I'm really impressed at the breadth of their knowledge. From their work with this new evolution of the MBTI, and they'll tell you lots more about that, the Singer-Loomis, and the work they've been doing with it. But they work with organizations, with individuals, have spent a fair amount of time overseas, so I figured that they were okay working with people from Seattle, even though they were from Portland. And that they'd be able to adjust to our strange abilities and whatever. So thank you very much. I welcome both of you, and we're pleased to start. Thank you.
It's really good to be here tonight, and we've been looking forward to this opportunity. And let me practice getting out of the way of the Matterhorn here. Okay. We want to start by giving you some idea of why we got into this topic and what fascinated us about it and pulled us into trying to work on this for as many years now as we've been doing that. Why look at individuation and why look at typology in particular? I started out with this years ago. In the 70s, really interested, or before that, in terms of my desire to go to school and graduate school and look at psychology in particular. But like many women my age at that time, got kind of delayed through that process with a couple of children and other ventures that kind of delayed that for a while. So I didn't actually do my doctoral work until the early 80s. The late 80s. I was working with organizations a lot and using typology to look at personality differences, leadership styles, conflict issues, team building, all those kinds of things, but also looking at a couple of boys that I was raising and how different they were, or relationships I was in and the issues I was having with some of those or others that went very well. So I had this curiosity. And then got involved in Jungian analysis, which really at the time I was in graduate school, which got me even more interested in what is this individuation process. But I was involved in a program which wouldn't let me look at the unconscious. They wanted it to be existential, consciousness-based. What is this idea of this other stuff that you're doing on Monday nights with James Kirsch or your analyst that you're seeing, and keep that stuff out of here. Well, as I went through graduate school, that started to change. So by the time I was ready to do my dissertation, that particular faculty said, sure, why don't you take a look at Jung's theory of individuation? We don't know of any research that's been done there that's been empirical. So I searched out, okay, I do typology. Because I had discovered that the subtitle to his book on psychological types, at least the Bain's copy, was the individuation process. Psychological types, the individuation process. So I looked at the Myers-Briggs, because that's what I used for years, and was surprised that I couldn't measure individuation with it. I couldn't look at people changing through their lifetime as they went from early adulthood on through. So I felt really stuck. Actually, Larry helped me out. He had seen a copy or reference to instrument by June Singer and Mary Loomis. And so I got up my courage to go up and meet with June Singer to ask her if I could use her instrument in my research. And she was very happy to do that. However, my second question was, yes, but I would like to do that research. I just learned from Larry that we weren't going to be in Los Angeles at the time. Could I do that in Pakistan? And that means I'm going to have to change some of your items to make them culturally appropriate and fit that culture. Well, June was very gracious about that and said she'd love for me to be able to have that experience. It'd be helpful to her, too, and she would work with me in that process, and she did. So that's what led me into looking at individuation, giving over 1,000, copies of the instrument that June, the Singer Loomis Inventory of Personality, as it was called then, to a Pakistani sample size, and looking at that in a cross-sectional study through the lifespan. I had people in their 20s up to, actually had a couple people in their 90s that took it. I did stop the study at about age 60 in terms of what I felt was feasible for what we were doing. So that's how I got into this. And I'll let Larry, you want to take it from there?
I'll try. Well, for me, I came into Jung from the point of view of human development. In graduate school, I was involved in the applied behavioral sciences and in teaching and learning about organizational behavior, organizational psychology. And at that time, which was back in the 60s and or late 60s, there was a lot of emphasis on the human potential movement, which basically was a variation on the issue of individuation as I came to understand it in Jung later. So I spent quite a bit of time rummaging around in all the different models and theories and that sort of thing. Then I had a friend at the University of North Carolina introduce me to Edward Inninger, and that really opened my eyes. It was like, oh, wow, here's a whole much more interesting, much more deep approach to understanding human development based on Jung. And that really was the turning point. And I started using a variety of Jungian materials in graduate classes and taught organizational behavior and integrated into my own consulting practice a variety of different things in terms of leadership development. And then another colleague introduced me to the MBTI. Now, this is in the early 70s. And I found that very helpful in terms of management development training. And I really hadn't read that part of Jung. I hadn't gotten involved in typology at all. I'd been much more drawn toward symbols and archetypes and the human development from that point of view, depth psychology in that sense. But I found the MBTI a very interesting instrument to use. I liked the theory. The theory made a lot of sense to me. And so I started using it. And I used it for about 15 years, I guess, until, as Elizabeth is telling you, she was doing a dissertation. Well, frankly, I was a big skeptic of something other than the MBTI at that point. I was a seasoned practitioner who was deeply committed to it. And for a year while we were there in Pakistan, I was quite critical of the whole idea of doing something that was not exactly tailored off of the Myers-Briggs. But I began to come around. I began to see different things and get interested in it. And the long and short is, then I got caught. And then I really got interested in June Singer and Mary Loomis's approach to typology and what that offered, and particularly how it opened up a lot of possibilities for looking at human development and understanding differences. So that was really how, what brought me into this area. So, having said that, what we'd like to do is take a few minutes and give you a sense of where we're going to go tonight, because there's really like three parts to what we're going to do. I'm assuming I can get this to work. Whoop, it'd help if I pushed the right button. All right, here we go.
This is going to be an experience on handling things back and forth and juggling about.
Sure.
So, a little multitasking here. One of the things that I wanted to go through, and I can't help but just add in terms of, I'll never forget the time I finished the dissertation. We're getting ready to leave Pakistan, and Larry is talking about what we're going to do when we return to Portland. And he's mentioning that he's interested in looking at typology. And I mean, having just gone through, and those of you that have done dissertations, I mean, what you want to do after you finish it is not particularly pick up and do more. So it was, I'll never forget sitting on that blue sofa having him tell me that this was something he was interested in continuing. So here we are, we're still doing this. That was 1991. Okay, so one of the things we're going to look at tonight is what was happening to Jung. What was he going through that had him formulating individuation? What led to some of those experiences of his and his ideas about personality functioning?
The next thing we want to do is to move from the point of view of Jung's, the things that were kind of the drivers for Jung's approach to individuation and his approach to typology, and look at how that evolved, and look at it from kind of stepping back and taking a perspective. Maybe it's a little different than you typically do when you're looking at inventories and psychological tests. So we're going to be talking about what we're calling the first generation, or generation one of typology, and generation two. And we'll give you examples of that, how they're different and what they're trying to do. And we're not going to go into a lot of numbers. You're not going to be faced with massive statistics or anything like that. We can't stand them any more than you can, believe me. But nevertheless, we will be talking about how they operate. So we're trying to take this at a conceptual level and work our way through that and how typology has evolved.
You'll click the clicker there.
Well, the last thing we're going to do is we're going to spend...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Part three is we're going to spend some time talking about how you can apply, how you can use generation two to bridge to the question of individuation. We don't have the answers for the measure of individuation, but we've got some ideas that we wanted to share with you about how you could approach that and how you could do some things to explore that. There I go again, the wrong side.
Wrong side? Okay.
Here. Whoop, there we go.
So, see, these are some of the factors that were behind and stirring Jung to look at the approach to his to psychological development overall. And his interest in what he called the individuation process, starting out and looking at some of what Freud's work was, as you've probably heard, and then moving on into the lifelong process, what was happening at midlife, what types of things brought that about. And then we want to also focus a great deal on Jung as the scientist, the empiricist, how that worked with the word association test and his discovery of the archetypes. And we'll go into that a little bit more deeply, too. And especially Jung and the concept of dialectical reasoning as it was used and understood, especially in Europe, and where he was in his background in training and learning about that. Now, this evolution of Jung's typology concepts I think this is of a, the chicken and the egg, which came first, the individuation concepts or his ideas around typology. They were growing together. Also looking at his observation and participation in the analytic society with Adler and Freud and observing interactions that they had. And coming up with just what is it that is driving a particular individual to behave the way they do, and what brings that changes about. So we want to get more deeply into those particular areas.
This, I think this quote, I found this quote very interesting because he's really talking about some major ideas that influenced him intellectually, as well as talking about the environment and the context he grew up in. If you've been in Europe, as I'm sure many of you have, it's not unusual to see a house that's got a marker on it, 1540 is when it was built or something like that. You know, from the United States, it's like something over 50 years old is really ancient. You know, there it's like nothing. You know, there's a whole different orientation toward history and time. And I think that kind of captures that, I think, as well as the business of Kant and Schopenhauer. Now, and Darwin, you know, three major streams of ideas that were very, very powerful in Europe and had a huge influence over Jung. We're not going to go into any depth in Schopenhauer, so you can kind of relax on that. So can I. nor will we be going in depth on Kant, except to talk a bit about dialectics and how you can see that playing out all the way through everything Jung does. It's really important to understand that that's like a frame, a backdrop that informs so much of his work. And also, when you look at the business of individuation and his idea of the self as the organizing, integrating archetype of the psyche, what you've got there is something that has echoes of Darwin in it also, because there's a teleology, there's a projection, a direction that's involved. So that's where we're going, and that we kind of like this little quote because it gives you a feel for Jung and kind of what were the major streams influencing it.
And I'm going to talk about a little bit about an experience that we had this fall, actually. Came from, we had a family reunion that was on the Merrimack River just north of Boston, and it happened that the house that got selected was built in 1760, and that in itself is quite interesting to move walk into that house. But not only was it built in then, which is fairly old for this country, not compared to Europe, but it gave us an appreciation of this particular quote, when you go into an environment and you're in it, because inside that house was all the furniture that family, it was still in the same family's ownership, 12 generations. And they had all the furniture that they had accumulated through those years. It was incredible. You opened little drawers and it had notes that had the date, 1811. You had pieces of silver that was collected, something that was written to Sarah on her birthday, and the chairs you sat in, and suddenly you were feeling you back in time. You looked out across the meadow, and there were wild turkeys walking around. And here I'm thinking, I'm just north of Boston. You know, this is 2007. And yet, as we were there for 6 days, we felt ourselves, the quilts on the bed, you know, all the beds themselves were, and we found ourselves sinking back into reflection and into time, feeling this difference. And I'm sure you've had experiences of the same type, of how in that those environments just kind of affect us in so many different levels that we're not aware of.
We wanted to go now to focus a bit more specifically on how Jung conceptualized individuation. And we thought this little quote captures it pretty well. Because basically, he's talking about a process of differentiation, a process of practicing the handoff, which we have yet to master. And Differentiation, I think, really sits at the heart of Jung's idea of individuation. And it's at the heart, I think, of his idea of typology also. So he one of the things he did that I found in fact preparing for this presentation, I went back and was reading some of the original material, some of Jung's original material, particularly the Bain's translation of typology. And you know, you can't help but come away from that with this feeling of an encounter with just an unbelievable intellect, an unbelievable breadth of information that he was bringing to bear to really look at how do people differentiate, how do we develop, how could we possibly understand that? And it really is kind of awesome, you know, frankly. I really walked away from that kind of surprised, actually, you know, on how much of a surprise that was to read that material again. So one of the things that he said in that really surprised me, I didn't remember this at all, and I'll quote this to you. Before individuation can be taken as a goal, the educational aim of adaptation to the necessary minimum of collective standards must first be obtained. A plant which is brought to the fullest possible unfolding of its particular character must first be able to grow in the soil in which it is planted. I was surprised by that. That whole business of really focusing on adaptation with the environment as the first keystone before you could really do individuation, before you could have that as a goal. I didn't really get that before when I read that particular book. So I wanted to share that with you. And I think you wanted to say something about June Singer, Elizabeth.
Okay, I borrowed that because I'm just looking at it. Okay. I thought that June ended her chapter on Jungian typology in Boundaries of the Soul. You may have read that book. And she talks about how differentiation begins very early when we kind of discover the difference between myself and others, or even other things, that I am not just one with everything, and how that differentiation continues and gets more complex. And she, this is a quote from the end of that chapter. "You are gazing into a quiet pool in which the moon is seen whole. When a stone is thrown into it, the image fragments. This is what consciousness does. The danger with typology is that when we focus on the fragments, we tend to lose sight of the whole. And that's the uniqueness of the individual that we're looking for."
The other thing, another thing I want to emphasize is just the extent to which Jung, another thing that you need, I think is important to understanding how Jung went at individuation and typology, is he was a thoroughgoing empiricist, and he really got involved in the word association test. How many of you know about that, about his involvement? Okay, great, then I won't belabor that at all, except that one of the things that we found in the literature is C.A. Mayer is talking about how Jung really actually developed his ideas about typology. They had their roots in the word association test. That was new. I didn't know that before. And he talks about how Jung identified two different attitudes, which led then to the idea of extroversion and introversion. So the word association test and that empiricist orientation that Jung had is another really important consideration when it comes to the business of understanding individuation and understanding typology. There we go. Now, this picture actually is taken when Jung was a student in the university, and I think it's an important picture to associate with this statement. The statement was written by in 1988, but it's a very nice, I think, summary of what's involved in dialectics. And that picture, the important part of it there is that Jung gave a lecture when he became student president of the student body at the university, and that lecture was about Immanuel Kant, and it is an amazing, amazing piece of work. If you ever have a chance to read it, I think it's in the International Association of Analytical Psychologists. International Association of Analytical Psychology. Their conference was held in Chicago. It was about 8 or 9 years ago. They had a proceedings that came out of it, and that was reprinted in it. But it's an amazing piece because what you can see vividly is how profoundly he was influenced by Immanuel Kant and Kant's whole idea of dialectics. And I had never ever seen that so explicit. So anyway, that's why that picture is important, because that's basically when that picture was taken about that time. Are you okay with this? This formulation about this process? I think the important thing to understand about it is notice that the idea is that the opposites are connected. They never are separated. There's never a separation. There's always it's a question of the relationship between them. So that there's continuity and change is involved in dialectics. Not just change, there's continuity. And not just continuity. So it really represents a very different point of view, one very different than we tend to have here in the United States, that's for sure.
So these early steps, and I'm going to read you a little bit of quotes here that describe some of what he was going through in this process. And this, again, is from Mayer in 1986, who was a Swiss researcher, analyst, and educator, as well as a longtime friend and colleague of Jung. He reported that Jung's most important contribution to psychology was the discovery and practice of the process of individuation. And according to Mayer, individuation begins and ends with typology. Although Jung did not mention type frankly in subsequent work, Mayer felt that he really did was to devote the rest of his life to the amplification of the dynamics of the individuation process, the blueprint of which is already nearly given with typology. Mayer noted that in 1923, the Bain's translation of psychological types was given the subtitle The Psychology of Individuation. Unfortunately, the whole revision of Bain's translation, the one referenced in this review, dropped the subtitle. And that was a big surprise to us, that there's so much difference between those two translations. Bain's worked directly with Jung and translating into English. The whole translation that was not possible to do, or that didn't happen anyway. So when we would compare paragraphs out of both of the books, we would find very different statements. And given the history of the Bain's translation, we decided to base our work on Bain's. And we had had several years of work with James Kirsch on Monday evenings, is what I was thinking of. Where he would point out the differences. James worked directly with Jung. He was from Germany, and so he knew the language, and would tell us the differences in translations as we were working. So that also added to our interest in making sure we were working with somebody who had that background. Although the original subtitle is mentioned in the editorial note of the Hull revision, an explanation for this omission is not given. When conducting his thesis study in 1904, Jung became aware of a significant dichotomy in the attitudes of his subjects. This difference in attitudes became evident through subjects' responses towards word association tests. This reminded Jung of the dichotomy made by William James of the differences between tough-minded and tender-minded people. In Jung's observation from his word association test, tough-minded corresponded approximately to the extroverted attitude and tender-minded to the introverted. However, these concepts and his definition of them, he coined the fair extroverted and introverted, but when he presented these concepts in a paper that he read at the Munich Psychoanalytic Congress in 1913, there was a lot of controversy among the analysts and researchers by his definition of the introverted attitude. It makes me wonder what their attitude might have been. This eventually led Jung to formulate the concept of the subjective factor for introversion and allowed Jung to tie the concept to a creative, not neurotic, role and related it to both conscious and unconscious processes. Now, the four functions were also detected in early observation through the word association test, but he reported those later. Meyer explained how several colleagues helped Jung differentiate the role of the four functions from the two attitudes. Hans Schmidt Goisson helped clarify the extroversion was not necessarily correlated to feeling, as Jung had earlier noted. Tony Wolf helped establish sensation and intuition as the orienting functions of consciousness, and Emo Mettner was particularly helpful in the involvement of the intuitive function. So he wasn't working alone. And I think that's enough from this point.
Now, the other thing is that at this point in time, Jung is in his late 30s, early 40s. I think that's a consideration, too, when he's writing this. He was a seasoned individual who spent a lot of years working as a psychiatrist. He had a lot behind him by at this point in time. So he was a little bit different from the kind of firebrand graduate student, university student you saw him earlier. Okay, now what we'd like to do, and I want to move through this fairly quickly, but I want to do this to try to give a framework for looking at what is involved in translating typology into paper and pencil tests. As you probably know, even today in the Jungian community, there are a lot of people who absolutely abhor any kind of paper and pencil test. I mean, they'll virtually run you out of the room if you even mention something like that. Now, I'm not, I'm just saying that's the way they see it. They see it as restrictive of the client and on and on and on. So this is not, when this first started, the whole business of trying to develop paper and pencil tests to measure typology, that was a big thing. And what I'd like to do is to suggest that there's a framework here you can use to begin to look at the whole business about paper and pencil tests and the business of the kind of work that Jung did. And the way that you can look at that is represented to it. We can quickly understand it, I think, by looking at this little graphic here. The expert observation is really the person who is developing the concept, who's got the idea, the way of interpreting, the way of diagnosing. Because diagnosis means application of knowledge. So whenever anybody is diagnosing what's going on in the situation, they're applying knowledge, concepts, categories, ideas, theories to understand it. Well, what that means is they're influencing the definition of that situation very significantly. So it's a unilateral kind of influence, and it's quite different from the subject's point of view. The subject will tend not to have the same concepts, will tend not to have the categories and all that. It'll be a much more undifferentiated kinds of experience. But what we're talking, the key thing here is a business about observation. And what Jung was a very skillful observer, an extraordinarily skillful observer. So that business about observation, I think you can see, is something we can translate into, and I'll show you how I think we can translate the same idea into the business of paper and pencil tests. And this is the kind of thing that are legitimate issues with paper and pencil tests that are important never to lose sight of. I don't care whose paper and pencil test it is. These are all legitimate issues, particularly the one on the bottom. The one about there's always measurement error. No test has ever been developed, nor will, I would argue, ever be developed that will measure completely and totally accurately what it's trying to measure. It's just impossible. And some of it for the reasons above, but just it's intrinsically extraordinarily difficult. Now, there's a conclusion to be drawn from all that, and that is, and that's the point of view that we take on paper and pencil tests, whether it's our own or the MBTI or the Great Wheelwright or whatever, doesn't matter. And that is that it should never be taken as a final word. It should always be related to experience. We were talking earlier, and that's what you're doing. I'm delighted to know that you're doing that, because that's really the way the acid test, I think, for an inventory and the results of it is. You bring it into your life and you check it out. Do these results really make a difference to me? Do they help me understand how I'm operating in this world internally and with the world? And do they move me along a road that I wouldn't necessarily be moving before in a way that's sensible? So that, I think, is the key thing to draw from those concerns. Now, that's the downside. Then there's an upside. And that's that a good psychological test really has to be carefully constructed. And it is a huge labor to struggle with the words, the language of scales, the language of items, and all that. And it's one thing to struggle with all that, but it's another thing to get it to all hold together and work. And the thing about an inventory is that you don't draw a conclusion on a single observation. Every item in an inventory is an observation. I really encourage you to think about them that way. That every time you respond to an item, what that is an observation of something that was developed from some concept, like that slide we looked at earlier, some intellectual concept or some idea is behind it and driving its development. And it ends up being maybe a purely descriptive statement that you can read and say, oh, I can relate to that directly. But it really is a statement that's an expression of some theory. A good one is, anyway. And it's the business of drawing that language. I mean, I can tell you, frankly, from the case of the Singer-Loomis, when we first got involved in it, we were shocked to find in the inventory, in the version we saw, version 4, first version we saw, June and Mary were using the language of going to the theater. And our first reaction to that was, wait a minute, there are a lot of people in this culture who would never see themselves going to the theater. You know, they might go to the movie, you know, but a theater? Uh-uh. There's a big portion of the population that have a very hard time identifying with that. So that's just an example. It's very hard to not have your own life experience get entangled up in how you define items and how these items are developed. And a lot of the tools, of course, have developed through time to help minimize that. And then they're tested and retested to make sure that they're doing what they're supposed to do. So these are the strengths. And the last thing I think is particularly important, that is it provides a way of efficiently and quickly gathering a lot of information that it would take a long time to come to the same point. Again, not to say that's truth, but simply to say it's a very systematic process. And I think this is the bottom line that I want to offer you that I think is quite important. And that is that a well-designed test is like a carefully refined observation that's developed and developed and developed to give you the results that you get. It's a far cry from our casual sort of observation, well, this person is an extroverted thinking with a little bit of introverted feeling and da-da-da. You know, that's pretty casual. It takes a lot of, you know, Jung was famous at one point for saying, how long does it take you to know what a person's type is? And he said about 25 years, you know. So it's something that I think is really a challenge to do and do well. So now there are a number of different ways in which you can go at this business of observation, and I'm not going to bore you with all the different categories, but the thing I want to point out to you is that some of these techniques allow for the person who is responding to the item to have more or less influence over the definition of the outcome. Are you with me on that? Okay. And that's what this is trying to show. So the forced choice category, of course, those of you who are familiar with the MBTI, you know that's the methodology that underlies it. The Singer Loomis uses a Likert scale, which is something, if you've taken inventories, you're familiar with it. It's simply a range. It asks you how much usage of something. So it's really designed to measure degree of. And self-anchoring scales on the far end there are scales where you put the extremes on the scale and then drop in the other categories. But all of the categories are still developed by somebody else. They're not something that's your own creation. That's more rare. Probably the Likert scale, Thurstone, to some extent, and forced choice are the most common systems of gathering information used in paper and pencil tests. So, to look at the first generation of typology, it's important, I think, to understand the context. So now we're talking about the 1940s. And we're talking about a period of time when the whole business, there was a raging controversy going on in the social sciences generally, and including in psychology, included in that biology, about the issues of how people are. Are they a product of nature or nurture? Are we a product of the environment? Are we a product of our instincts, of inner development processes? And people fell out on one side of that or on the other. And either-or categorization was very typical, and I'm stepping outside of Jungian psychology. But if you look at the field of leadership, for years, the prevailing point of view was you're either a born leader or you're not. There's nothing you can do to develop yourself as a leader. You just got it or you don't, and that's it. And that same kind of frame of reference permeated a lot of the way that people were thinking and developing their ideas about human development and human beings at that point in time. At that point in time, statistics, because of World War II, became way more sophisticated. There was a big push in the services to develop ways to make assessments and accurately assess whether or not people would be able to handle being soldiers performing in the battlefield and so on. So there was a huge amount of research went on, and that was accompanied by the need for statistics, which led to a big development in statistics. And an outgrowth of that was very sophisticated tools like factor analysis and things like that that came out directly out of World War II, which are currently tools that are still used. And as a result of all that, self-reporting, paper and pencil tests, which were not invented in the 40s, obviously, but they really gained a lot of credibility during that period of time. That's what's important to understand about the context in which that was going on. Now, when it comes to the MBTI or the Gray Wheelwright or Kiersey Bates, thank you. Kiersey Bates, all three of those inventories, and I picked those three because I think those are the sort of seminal first generation type inventories. All of them are based on the idea of opposites in the sense of forced choice and polarity. So that you get pairs like introversion and extroversion are treated as opposites. So you're forced to choose. Do you choose introversion, an item that represents that as an observation of you, or do you choose extroversion as an item that represents that as an observation about you? And the same thing for intuition, sensation, thinking, feeling, judging, and perceiving. I'm assuming those are concepts you're familiar with. If you're not, I'll stop and explain a little bit, but I'm assuming that you're okay with that. Okay. The way it works then is you're required to choose one member from a pair of forced choices, things where they're opposites. And then the most frequently chosen member is used to reveal the type. So you're not actually measuring, if you stop and think about it. When you go to measure something, you roll out where you can find out what the distance traveled is, right? Or how much of something, what degree of. That's not measuring when you pick this versus that. You're really categorizing, okay? So those technically are known as a nominal scale. They're not really technically measurement. It's a methodology for categorizing something. And I think that what's interesting about this is, you know, Jung didn't develop any of this. The people who developed this, particularly the Myers and Briggs, that was a that was a breakthrough thing for them to do, to figure out a way to bring out an inventory that was not pathology-oriented and that measured, that generated information about typology that was, as they saw it, consistent with what Young had to say. And it was a huge monumental achievement, and it's been a monumental success. You know, there's no other inventory in the history of inventories that's had any kind of even approaching the success of that inventory that the MBTI particularly has had. Now, so the last point here, though, I think is particularly striking, and that is that if you were to take apart any one of those three inventories, what you'd find is you have these pairs, and then you take logic and you say, if this, then this, and if that, then this, and if this, then that. That's never measured. Those linkages have never been measured. They're all conceptual. They're not empirical. Are you with me? Okay. That's a really important thing to understand. Those are assumptions, and I'm not saying they're wrong. I'm just saying, you know, in terms of science, what you want to do is test your assumptions, right? You want to keep pushing out the frontiers of where you can make warranted statements. So that's really important, I think, to understand about the logic, and that's how you end up with the four-letter designation. Okay, and here's a quick illustration of that. So you're given to at parties, this is from the Gray Wheelwright, at parties I like to talk, I like to listen. So I'm just trying to give you a quick sense of how this procedure works, that the underlying procedure that gives you the results. So what happens is, let's say in item one, that's item one in the inventory, if you pick A, that represents extroversion, B, which you might have found yourself saying, well, I also listen, but I'm choosing this. Well, see, there's an investment of energy, psychological energy and experience in this element here. Now, what happens with that is there's many ways you could treat that center column, but basically it's discarded, it's not counted, it no longer has any bearing on the outcome. That's a key point right there. Then let's say this is the second item, but maybe it's a different pair that you have, and they respond to that, and the same thing goes along. So what happens is you see that, and this would actually, in the way the instruments are designed, it would happen anywhere from 17 to 21 times are you picking from pairs, depending upon what the pair is that's being addressed. But let's say, just use this as a prototype, what you do is you total the column and you say, okay, extroversion is chosen 3 times. Okay? And you go over here and you say introversion is chosen twice. Okay, that means that the difference between those two is 1 point. So we'll say that that means extroversion is a preference. That's the way the person prefers to operate. Okay? So that's the logic underneath that.
I don't understand what you mean.
I'm sorry?
I don't understand what you mean by non-counting.
Ah. Well, these items in here are if this is the one related to extroversion and you chose it, okay, this item here, like to listen, you never do anything with it from that point forward. It just completely falls out of the system. The only thing you pay attention to is the ones that were selected. Okay? Yes? No, it's a product of the structure. It's a product of the methodology itself. Because the assumption is that you're dealing with opposites, you can't have one you have to have one and not the other.
Okay.
But the point is, that's a very powerful assumption that's underneath that. Okay, and that is that this other that's there isn't worth attending to, or wouldn't make a difference if you did attend to it, because cumulatively that could add up to a significant difference, right? So that's the structure that underlies that. Yes. Five different sets of pairs.
And then how do you get a V and an I for knowing A and B?
Oh.
Question 5.
I'm sorry?
Question 5.
Oh, you get that by not changing it and leaving that blank in there. That's my mistake. That should be an A. Okay. That's just a mistake.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Sorry about that. I didn't catch that. What?
The significance of a one with the.
Oh, it's you see the difference.
Yeah, I saw where you got this.
Okay.
What the significance of it.
Oh, well, you end up with four. With the Myers-Briggs, you end up with four. With Kersey Bates, you end up with four letters that are the keystone for then applying the logic to define your type. Okay?
It's
so how? That's how you get those letters.
I got the letter. The number that goes with it, is that a weighted number?
Ah.
Should it be E2, E3, and you interpret it differently?
Yeah, there is a weighting that is associated with that. It's fairly complex, but it's there. Yeah, if you were to go back to the arcane days when they had the hand scoring templates that you laid on them, what you'd find is some items are weighted 2 points and some items are weighted 1 point. So there's a weighting involved in that. It's kind of like a Thurstone scale in that sense, but the whole methodology is not. It's purely forced choice. Yes. Yes.
It shows you kind of where you are.
Yes.
You could be an extreme extrovert, you could be
right.
In the middle of the line.
So the magnitude of that score, see, this would be problematic as an extrovert.
Yeah.
You know, because partly that's just an artifact of the fact that I only had five pairs. You'd have like 20 pairs, and so you'd have, you know, and your score, because they are weighted, would be higher than that. Mm-hmm. So. But if that was the actual result, you know, that you say from the Myers-Briggs or the Gray Wheelwright, then that would be somebody who's just barely an extrovert.
Yeah.
They barely prefer extroversion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but that number there is just an artifact of a small number that I use. Okay, so that's really what I'm trying to do is convey to you sort of what was behind the development of the first generation, how Jung's frame of reference set the framework for that, and how this methodology is a reflection of trying to address what Jung had to say. Yes?
How did they calibrate the language so that it gets consistent results across the country, Ann Arbor, Mexico, and so on, and young people whose their definition of a party is different from ours, or liking to listen is different from ours, you know what I mean?
Well,
that's leading right into part of what we want to get to, too.
Yes, but I guess the quick answer to you to stay within this framework, okay? The way they do that is they administer a series of pairs of words to a variety of different people, and then they do a technical analysis like factor analysis to find out which clusters of words really hang together tightly, and then those words are translated over into the inventory itself. So the idea is that, and that's the error of measurement problem. Because you can't avoid the fact that there will be generational differences that look at an item. There will be background and cultural differences when they look at an item. You can't avoid that. So you have to struggle, really struggle, and use all the tools you can to come up with something that will bridge across.
Can I ask something?
Yeah.
The same person who chooses to talk at a certain party,
mm-hmm.
depending on so many different variants, you know, external.
Right. That's right. See, now what you're raising is the direct lead into where we're going. Because what's embedded, as I heard you anyway, in what you just said, is context makes a difference in how much you'd listen. Okay? You see that one of the things about this is an example of some of the kinds of items. Often the items are just two words. Choose which of these two words you prefer. So what they are is they're context-free. They're not really tied into this setting here, for example, where I'm going to be different than I am if I'm at a bank, okay, trying to get a loan on a house, let's say, or something. So you see, it's context-free. And the reason that doesn't matter is because from this framework, these are inborn traits, period, comma, period, comma, period. That's it, okay? The idea is that these are inborn capacities, and the environment impacts them, but what's driving development is really coming from those inborn capacities. And that's why it's okay to have, from this point of view, to have context-free approaches to the items. Is that making sense to you all? Okay.
Is this context-free terminology good for the projection? For example,
yes.
I like to talk, but unconsciously I like to listen, and I circle B, without knowingly, basically.
Right. Precisely. Now, and you see, therein lies the dilemma. Mm-hmm. Therein lies the dilemma. Because with a paper and pencil test, you want to try to minimize that projection. Mm-hmm. Okay? You don't want you to project this and he projects that on the same item. Mm-hmm. Okay? Because what that means is you're not really addressing the same variable. And presumably your items are all targeted on a particular, each item is targeted on a particular variable. Okay? I mean, scientifically, that's what you would be seeking, right? So, but you're absolutely right. That's the problem of context-free. It's like ink blots, the Rorschach, That's context-free. And so person's free to, put everything, just dump the psyche on it. And all the stuff that they're carrying around with them gets projected onto that. Yeah. Oh, thank you. What time is it? Oh, okay. All right. So now we are going to accelerate because we've got about yay many slides yet to go through. The material we'd like to cover with you tonight if we possibly can.
Because we're doing questions.
Yeah.
But we probably need to do it in the next 5 minutes.
Okay. All right.
Well, why don't I do this particular one since my initial is Sonic. And what this leads to June and Mary and what they were trying to do when Mary was doing her dissertation, and June had this experience, so she went to her and said, "Would you supervise me on this?" And so they start working together. And June was quite upset at that point in terms of typology and how she had been assessed when she was at the institute and was labeled as an introverted thinking type. And she was disturbed by that because she also felt she had a lot of extroverted feeling. And according to the opposites, they shouldn't be there together. And she just couldn't think of herself as not that way. But she could understand how her analyst really saw the introverted thinking, because that was what was operating a great deal in her analytic sessions. However, she was also going through a lot in her life at that point that was calling for introverted thinking, and a lot of her downplaying of extroverted feeling was a coping mechanism at that point. So anyway, she was interested in working with Mary, and Mary wanted to look at, was this really true, this bipolar assumption, does it hold? So they looked for a way to take apart the Gray-Wheelwright and the Myers-Briggs, separate those forced choice items. They wanted to see if that structure, the forced choice, was creating kind of a false report in terms of people's types. So if they took the item of the one that you saw about at a party, I like to talk, and put that on a Likert scale of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, to what degree do you like to talk, and then have the person answer that item, and then have them answer the item on I like to listen, to what degree, 1 through 5, and then look to see, did that change their most developed, their superior function? Would that make a difference? And I'd like to ask you just to think about that. Do you think it would? Or would it make a difference in what is the least developed, the inferior?
I want to put it in context. If you think about this, when they were doing this was 1979, those inventories were very, very well established. I mean, there are literally tens of thousands of people who are using them every day.
We'd like to get started again, and what we want to pick up on now is to talk a bit more about the business of the second generation of approaches to typology. And here, the context now that we're talking about is like the 1970s, late 70s, early 80s. So in that context, there are a lot of things coming out, like andragogy was a very popular, Andragogy was also popular, but that's a different matter. We're talking adult education then. But androgyny was a very widely talked about idea. The whole business of nature and nurture was gaining a great deal of credibility and becoming a point of view that a lot of people held. And it's continued to grow, of course, through time. So that was a difference in the context. The whole business of statistical tools just has exploded. I mean, if you ever have seen this thing called SPSS, Statistical Package for the Social Sciences, if you looked at it 10 years ago and you looked at it now, it would just boggle your mind. I mean, the incredible things that you can do with those tools. I don't begin to understand them mathematically, but I do know a little bit about what you can do with them, and it's just staggering, the power of those things. As a tool to help you understand how to develop and understand differences and test variables and so on. And there is also a growth in the whole business. Now here is kind of a controversy, and it's still going on at the level of tests about situation-free versus context-based approaches to measurement. There's a whole school now, they have their own journals and all that, that's all about context personality development, context-based personality development. And there are a lot of people who are still subscribing to the whole business of context-free techniques of measurement, partly because that's particularly well adapted to a particular statistical tool, a factor analysis. I shouldn't have done that because I can't really get into the details. But basically, all I want to say to you is this. It's a tool that works supremely well with context-free items. Okay, it's a very, very powerful tool for working with those. So that's the kind of context in which then we're talking about the development of the second generation of typology instruments. What's it going? Huh. There we go. Okay, so now what we're talking about, do you want to do this?
I was going to pick up one after that.
Oh, after this, okay. All right, then I'll crank through this real quickly. What you see now, just like we tried to show you how assumptions and ideas are reflected, that are made, get reflected in the actual approach to the inventory. The idea of the Singer-Loomis is nature and nurture, okay? So as a result, you get presented with 20 different situations and all of the type modes, that is to say the extroverted or introverted side of each of the four functions is in each one of those 20 situations. All eight are there. So the whole approach to measurement is different in that sense. And it measures degree of usage. So it has you responding on a scale, how much you're using something, how much you're doing something. And it represents, it's a reframing of what is your point of measurement. Remember we talked about the pairs, E and I, J and P, S and N, T and F, okay? That's the point of data gathering with the first generation. With this generation, the point of data gathering is the extroverted expression of a function. Or the introverted expression of a function. So that's the target. That's what you gather data about. And then you build everything from that. So it's a completely different process in that regard. Is that making sense? Okay. All right. And in this context, introverting, extroverting, judging, and perceiving are aggregate variables. In other words, extroverting is based on extroverted sensing, extroverted intuiting, extroverted thinking, extroverted feeling. See, that's the commonality running through all of those. So that when you look at how much do you use all of those capacities, when you roll that up together, that gives you the measure of how much you're invested in extroverting. Similarly, the same thing with introverting. And for the judging, you look at the judging sides, the T and F, introvert, extroverted.
Just, I think we can do this very quickly over here.
So that's what also is different about how the information is generated that gets the results of the inventory.
Okay, so if you look over here, if we look at the top, sorry, here's your four types of introverted perceiving and extroverted perceiving. So add up all four of these, you get perceiving. If you add up all four of these, you're going to get the judging. The introverted feeling, extroverted feeling, extroverted thinking, introverted thinking. If you add up all of these, you're going to get introversion. And if you add up all of these, you're going to get extroversion. Or if you take these two, you're looking at introverted and perceiving. And I'm just going to come down here as another. These two are going to be extroverted judging. So that's a way you can link them up. Okay.
So you end up, what you end up seeing then is how you do your introverting, for example, how you invest your energy in these four type modes that are the basis for introverting. And you see great differences in people. What we see is great differences in how people do their introverting. You know, some people draw much more heavily from some of these type modes than others. And there's a great deal of variability.
One thing that actually quite frightened me when I first realized this is when you looked at measuring people in each of these eight and getting scores for each eight, and you think of how many different types can you get? It was over 6 million. We are individuals. Okay. And here's just a contrast on the difference in meaning, going back to Baines, and introverted feeling and extroverted feeling.
So we did this not because it's distinctive necessarily to the Singer Loomis, but just we wanted to make sure that if anybody was in the audience that wasn't sure what we were talking about with extroverted feeling or introverted feeling, this would give you a sense of what how it's defined. That's all we're up to with this.
And we just chose feeling, as we could have done this for the other functions as well.
But you see, there's no real good, if you look at the language, and this was vividly clear to me again when I was going through the Baines translation of Jung's work on type theory, and that is that the language is not really consistent. This is a type, that's a type, this is a type, that's a type. You know, it's not really, there's a kind of vagueness to it. You're talking about a feeling type, okay? Well, then you say in the same breath, an extroverted feeling type. A judging type? We've just made major shifts along there. So that's why this language of type mode was created, because we're trying to get language that's consistent, that would provide a baseline that would be consistent, so that when we're talking about functions, that's the introverted and the extroverted expression of a function, okay? So that's simply the function. And then when we're going to the next level up, the business of introverting or extroverting and so on, why then we just thought that clarified. So that's what we did. Not without a little bit of anxiety about not wanting to contribute verbal pollution, you know, to what is already a complex area. Okay, so now again, in the same spirit as what we did a while ago, this shows you a quick example of how the data is collected. So what happens is a person is given a context. Given a context that's of what's the situation, and then here are all eight of the items, each one of which is designed to measure one of those eight variables. And then what happens is the person takes that scale running from rarely, representing 1, 5, almost always, and indicates to what extent would you do that in that situation. And there's no assumption that if you do one, you can't do the rest. It's a question of how much would you do this in that situation. And the same thing happens for 20 different situations. So all of the items that have to do with EN are recorded. So you get 20 measures of EN, 20 measures of IN, 20 measures of each one of the type modes. So we end up with exactly the same number of measures at the end of the process of each one of those areas. And then that's what you're comparing, where every one of them has been in the same situations. I mean, the situation has always been a constant. There's always been a situation that was the basis for measuring how much you do each one of those type modes. So that's the way this is. That's the way it's designed.
So you're picking up all that line and the other one that wasn't measured.
That's right. Remember the stuff that was in the center that's not counted? It's counted. So it helps to add to that picture. That's how you end up with a picture like this. Okay. Questions? Or do you, is this clear? Okay. All right. Then what we thought we would do now is spend a little time talking about some ways in which we've developed or some experiences we've had to relate the business of the paper and pencil test, in this case of Singer Loomis, to the issue of individuation. How might you use it to try to help promote individuation?
And people talking more, but the research, what I was trying to look at is, as I've said before, can we really see individuation by looking at people's and their typology? So I measured people that to see what happened across the lifespan, say from age 20, 30s, 40s, up to 60, and there would be I think it went from 1 to 11, the difference between the opposites. So I had ET versus IF. And I looked at men, I looked at women, and then there would be an aggregate. And what we noticed that we would start out with a difference about here, and then something funny started happening.
At midlife.
Now, I don't know what's going on there, but this midlife range actually went up to about 50. Something was happening. Now, I do have some more data that I could put in, but I stopped for that study at that point.
Would you say again what the amplitude represents?
Don't know.
All
I know is that instead of what I predicted was that the differences the individuation was going on, the bipolarity would be higher at 20, and I thought it would go down. They would become, they would individuate and use them more. And in fact, this happened. Yes.
Up means more bipolar.
Yes.
More like one or the other.
Right.
Is that okay?
Yeah. Higher bipolarity, lower.
Mm-hmm. Does it then, though, at 60 go down?
We need to look out.
Because even after 50, you're saying it went up, so even still there.
And does this mean integration is occurring as you get older? Mm-hmm. Or does it mean we're getting more rigid? I don't know. Is it me? We got complex. We have a lot of complex life events that has us reacting in different ways through here. I don't know.
So are you searching for yourself? You know, really questioning yourself and trying to integrate the opposite other in those, you know, midline. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I look at myself, if that's, and what is happening with me as I go through this. I look at my clients that I work with. We talk about that. Look at couples I work with. What is happening? And I think one of the things that I think we do develop very much, especially in intimate relationships, and one of the things I learned from Larry in individuation, I think, happens when you're with a partner, is that he used standing toe-to-toe, you need somebody that'll be there.
and face you back and back so that you can have the differences or the agreements, and that you both stand there and face each other. And so I'm projecting onto him. I have to hold that projection, that mirror, after a while. I have a chance to individuate and learn more about what wasn't there. And that has a lot to do. Now, you may notice already that we may not be the same typology. And that's
tell us that tomorrow, right?
Well, that's the rest of that will come out tomorrow, that right? But that's part of it, and that we were trying to get at. Then, how do we take and go to those external situations out there? One of the things, and I wasn't going to credit this guy for it, because he came up with something that I have started to use so much, and I think it's, I'm very excited about it. I'm even more excited about it than he is. But that is, typology isn't just in us. It's out there in the tasks that we do, the experiences that we have. So what, when I'm trying to balance my checkbook, God forbid, I have to use some of my least preferred type modes. You know, that's what's called for. That's what that task, I have to use that extroverted sensing, extroverted thinking stuff. And that is, so you look at, what do I have to use in a particular area that I'm working or what I'm drawn to, and hopefully it's something I enjoy. The other thing is teamwork. You've got members of a team. You want differences there. But they also need to be aware of, when they're doing a particular task, a team together, who has those natural skills to be able to pull that out, and who's going to show them something different and pull them out into a different way.
So,
yeah.
Is this
Pakistan? Yeah, Pakistan, yes. We haven't looked. Oh,
We've got the data. We just haven't looked at it relative to this.
3,000 samples at this time. We've looked at.
Brain does kind of seem like that shape of the life.
Yeah.
I've got to say that a Pakistani group I was reading yesterday said, because they came out introverted thinking overall and introverted, could you please go back and tell those people in the U.S.? Maybe they'll understand this better. And here we are, as a culture, extroverted thinking and extroverted sensing.
What?
I have one thought. I kind of got a lot of leadership about the company that we built 10 years ago, started out, which was leaders, the idea that leaders are born, not made.
Yeah, right.
And that, in fact, we've moved to, you can be a leader in lots of different ways. But when you are a leader, mm-hmm. you do tend to have to develop some things. Mm-hmm. That some of your areas that you haven't necessarily preferred, and that tends to happen in the middle of your life.
That's true.
So you tend to end up in a higher management,
that's
leadership,
right.
teaching,
that's right.
whatever job, in that time, when
right.
you would be, although you're doing your midlife work, but you're also trying to do your job.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So that might be what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Could be. The other thing that could be going on in that we speculated about is that where those waves were happening, when this data was collected, that more or less reflected the time when Pakistan separated from India. You know, so there could be some kind of a cultural impact that was going on at that same time that also could be involved in that. The other thing that we wanted to quickly just cover with you, and then we'll stop outputting and see where we are and what anything that you'd like to explore or anything we've talked about. One of the things that, because Elizabeth and I both have had a lot of experience doing management and organization development and trying to help people learn ways to do things differently and understand differences, I can go on and on. Okay, so the business about application, you know, becomes central if that's the kind of work that you do. Applying theories and ideas, and how do you make those practical for people to use. So one of the things that bothered us a lot about psychological inventories is you get this result and it's like, well, this is me and I'll just walk around with this because that's the way I am, you know. Well, wait a minute, how do I translate what I am to the environments I have to deal with? Not much help on that, is there? If you stop and think about it. You know, it'll tell you a lot about, well, you'll tend to do this or you'll tend to do that or whatever, but it doesn't really do like the question back here. In this context, what's going on? What would I do? How would I deal with that? Or what would it be over here? So that really, after a lot of kind of struggling around with that question, we came up with a very simple little idea. The idea is this: to take the type mode language, depersonalize it, where you're no longer really aimed at the individual psyche, but trying to describe circumstances that would be what would be called for by the environment. And so what you do is you define a situation that is critical to you. Maybe it's to your performance as a leader. When it comes to doing the, notice I'm putting more context on it, when it comes to doing the budget cycle, okay? And that's the context. Then the question is, if you're going to be effective in that context, how much do you need extroverted sensing? A little bit, some, a lot, a heck of a lot, okay? And the same thing for all of these. So what you can do is you can use these same concepts, put them into the environmental context, and say, okay, what's the environment call for? Then what you can do is you can take your profile, which looks exactly like this, and compare it with this and find out where there are gaps and where there's differences. And what our experience is, that's usually well correlated with major sources of stress. It's also a major area for development, okay? And so that's the thing that we use all the time now. Elizabeth is using it with her clients. Whenever I do training programs with the Singer Loomis, it's always right there. And we use it with teams. So we have the teams talk through, what are the major things that are the deliverables, the things that you have to do to be effective as a team? And they come up with five or six different situations. And then we ask them to assess them. Then they get a team profile so they can see kind of the culture that gets created as a result of all the people on the team. They can look at the individual's profile in relationship to the team's profile. They can look at the individual and the team's profile in relationship to what those critical tasks call for. And that gives them a basis then for looking at, in addition to how maybe you've had a ton of experience in this area, and even though your profile doesn't look like you're a very good fit, your experience carries you through it, okay? So it may be that's the basis that we allocated roles in our team, is how much experience do people have? Well, you can address the question of development. You can address the question of making you a mentor instead of having you be the lead person. You put some other people out there because you can see that they need to develop these capacities in themselves and so and how they can work. So that's some of the things you can do with that.
Can we go to the last?
Yeah, and I think that's in keeping with... I don't know what's going on, but it's there. Very entertaining. This is a quote that's out of that same Bain's translation of Jung, which I thought was quite remarkable. I had not seen that before until we were just going through it for this. And he says this almost at the end of the book. And the point, the context in which he's saying this is he's talking about personality, the development of type. And what he says is that if you're in enough in the same situation, what that tends to then create is an habitual response. And that's the basis for type. But if you think about now the context in which he was writing that back in 1910, 13, 15, 17, okay, that world was a very stable world, right, compared to our world. You know, our world is just constantly unmitigated change all the time. So it's a very different world, and I think it puts this statement in kind of a new light, because I think it really does then speak to the question of like how environment does have a bearing on how our personalities function and how you have to address both the intra and extra psychic processes to get to the whole person and to work on the issue of individuation. So I've just tried to quickly brushstroke in some ways in which we've developed a strategy for looking at how you could relate your profile to the environment and work on issues of development that way.
Well,
are there any questions? Yeah. Now, questions, anything, any confusions we can try to speak to? Or?
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD, and it included some images. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.